All right, so welcome everyone. CQRS talk. Hopefully you're in the right room. If not, you're not going, so stay here. So we're going to run through CQRS, what it means in terms of architecture and how to build applications. We're going to be talking about scale, performance, and all those sort of things. Just so I get a feel for the room, who's aware of what it at least stands for? That's a good start. Who's implemented something using the pattern? That's probably what I expected. Okay. So we'll do the introduction, which is this. Hi, that's me. You can find me later. Just search for me. Richard Banks, Twitter handle, email address. Too long, didn't read. Don't care. Okay. So what I want to do in terms of this talk is really position this as a way of approaching application design so that you can support, obviously, scale and performance in production and deal with a lot of the problems that you might currently have in terms of how your applications currently run and the types of results you end up getting when you build code. So we'll run through common problems, as you can see. What CQRS is, which I said before was kale, quinoa, rice, and sorghum, not realizing kale's spelled with a K because I'm awesome like that. And then some implementation, we'll show some code, and then how CQRS helps with DevOps. Now, this is pitched as a 300-level talk, mainly because I tend to go quickly with talks, and I throw a lot at you. I figure if you're coming to a conference, then it's my job to try and smash as much into your head as possible in as short a time frame as possible. So bear with me. If you get lost along the way, it's okay to start drooling out of the side of your mouth. Not a problem. And we'll go for it. All right, so I've got a list of 21 common problems coming up. Your job to start off with, just to make sure you're with me, is to count how many of them you currently experience. All right, so performance problems. Pages fast when it loads in under 3 seconds. Check. You get sent random sighted slow complaints, and you have no idea why, let alone being able to fix it. And I hit the blank button. Don't do that, Richard. Running a report stresses your application, makes things go slow. You have availability problems where you need to take the system down so you can run night jobs. You can't do live updates. Forget about that. That ain't ever going to happen. Data issues are the norm. In fact, they're so normal you don't actually fix the root cause of the data issue. You just write scripts to patch the problem. Anyone still going? 6 for 6 so far. Scalability, excessive compute capacity to support a small number of users where you think your server is running busy when there's 5 users on it and you're at 100% CPU. Your only approach to scale is vertical. The idea of going sideways, no chance. And you have to make sure all your servers run the same version. Hopefully not too many of these you're going, no, I haven't got all this. Mass assignment vulnerabilities. Audit logs show you what changed, but you have no idea why, if you've even got logs, that is. You have really horrible code trying to manage things like permissions and partial data access and so forth, and it's just a nightmare. You end up with user experience, meaning data grids. Okay, hands up. Let's just pause. Hands up. Who's this? Every application looks like a clone of Excel, right? Yeah. People do things with your app without understanding why. They just do it because, you know, you have to do it here because, I don't know, we just got told to do it. And then we have to repeat the same data in multiple places. We can't make non-conflicting changes to the same record, even if we need to. So we end up hearing people in our business going, who's got this locked? It's not just developers, right, using SourceSafe. architecture. Every app is basically a CRUD app. Doesn't matter what you're doing, it's a CRUD app. All your business logic's in the database. Any DBAs in the room? Right over in the corner. And your testers have to run complex SQL queries to figure out if anything works. In fact, your testers are probably better DBAs than your DBAs. What about code? You understand what the code does. You can read the code, but you have no idea why it's there. You're unsure if a change you make will break something somewhere else. This one's pretty common. Yeah, this could be pretty much the entire room, I assume. And if you need to make a new change for a requirement, you have to make it here, and here, and here, and here, and here, and behind your right knee, all that sort of stuff, all over the place. So how many got more than 5? Oh, jeez. More than 10? Yeah, okay. Did anyone get like jackpot and get all 21? Omar. we've all been there. We've all done this. These are all problems. The intent with CQRS is it gives us a way to solve some of these problems. So what's it stand for? Command Query Responsibility Segregation. Fair enough. You can take a photo. It's okay. Do you want me in it? okay, what's a command? A command, best way to think about it is something that represents a user's intention. They want to do something. So I want to open an account. I want to withdraw money. These are commands. They cause a change in application state. Fair enough. They don't return data, because if it returns data, it's a what? It's a query. Very good. Too easy. And generally, that means they either succeed and they work, or they blow up and throw a nasty exception. Fairly straightforward. Where a query, on the other hand, simply returns a view or a projection of data of the application state. Okay, so you'll hear different terms, projections or views and so forth. You'll hear read models, view models, projections. They're all the same sort of thing. They're just a slice across your application state that we're returning to the UI for someone to look at. We shouldn't end up having any changes to application state as a result of that. A query which changes the application state is not a query. It's a... I don't know what it is. It's a mess. It's not a command. It's not a query. It's just something. And we prefer queries to be specific rather than generic, because if they're too generic, they become too broad. People end up having to write their own application code on top of the application code just to try and make sense of it. All right, so how does this look visually? We end up with an app server. Yay! And we have a client application. The client application might have something crazy like some fields and a button. And when the user clicks a button, we've got an action. There's a user intention. They've done something deliberate. Therefore, we create a command. We send that to the server. That gets picked up by a command handler. The command handler changes application state. Fair enough. We then have another client application or a different view within the same application. It doesn't really matter. Where we might be doing a search, for example. The search is a query type operation, so therefore we represent a query. We send that through to the server. It's picked up by a query handler. There's different flavors of handler, so I use the term handler generically. There's query objects, query services, all these things. That's going to pick up data from the database and, unsurprisingly, return it back to the client. That's it. All right, thanks for coming, everyone. See you later. We'll go a bit deeper. We talk about performance and scale. If you think about the web, the way the web works, it's probably the biggest, most scalable CQRS system in the world. It's designed like this from the start. All those verbs on the left are queries. They're idempotent, they're repeatable, they're fast, they're cacheable, they're all these sort of things, but they query application state. They don't change anything. Whereas everything on the right-hand side, they're all commands. I'm putting something into a resource. I'm posting something into a resource. I'm patching an existing resource. I'm deleting a resource. They change application state. This is the most scalable way of building an application that we know of at this point in time, separating these things out. Why don't we do that in our own code? Because we don't think this way. Now, there are some other reasons people don't go down this path. They don't do CQRS because there's some misassumptions or invalid assumptions. And one of those is that it's difficult to implement and hard to maintain. It's not the case. Or that you have to use eventual consistency. Not the case. Or you have to use event sourcing. Not the case. Who's heard of event sourcing, by the way? Just so I know. Okay, so decent number. You don't need a message bus, and this won't fix all your performance and scale problems. Sorry. I guarantee you'll find other ways to write really slow code. All right, so we'll talk about three different flavors, what I'd call standard CQRS, the vanilla version, and then we'll talk about where eventual consistency kicks in and where event sourcing kicks in. After that, we'll also talk a little bit about what happens in production. If we roll this system out or we roll this design pattern out to production, what can we do with it in terms of monitoring our app in production so that we can see how things are going and whether our performance is actually good and how we're scaling. So, implementation. Dun, dun, dun. Bertrand Meyer, way back now, came up with a term called command query separation. And the idea is that in a single class, you have separate methods for querying state versus reading state. Very straightforward. As an example, you might get something like this. You can see we've got the getter on the property. That's a query. We're reading application state. And we might have a couple of methods that change state, such as activate and deactivate. Fairly simple, right? Where CQRS comes in is we take that concept and we make it a little bit more explicit by simply taking our things that change state versus those that read them and separate them into different classes. Why do we do that? We'll see. But the separation helps with a whole lot of things around scale and performance. Entity classes. Who's familiar with domain-driven design concepts or terminology? Okay, so if I say entities, aggregate roots, people aren't going to get lost too much. In a little bit. Okay, so an entity is a thing. Entity classes hold state. They represent state. Command handlers initiate and coordinate changes to those states. So an example here, I take that existing class I had before, user account, and I mark the methods that change state as internal. I don't want them accessed by anything other than the command handlers. If you're familiar with hexagonal architectures or ports and adapters, we can effectively treat our command handlers as the port into our domain, and then we will make our changes in there. So we're isolating it so we protect our domain, make sure it's only accessible from command handlers. If I've lost you there, I apologize, but it's a 300 talk. We'll keep going. And then I have a command handler here, and you can see this is fairly simple code. It's more to show you the concept rather than a full implementation, but something like activate account is a command. And you can see the wording of it is designed as how a user might interact with things. I want to activate an account. Well, let's call the method activate account. I know, it's genius. And the return type here is a void because a command either works or throws an exception. Fairly straightforward. And we come in, we find the account we're doing, we call the activate method on it. If it works, that's great, we'll log success. If it doesn't, we throw an exception. Simple pattern, simple to code. A query service is a projection of that state. So if I wanted to see things like what are my active accounts, I run a little link statement. And I return an enumerable of the account names that are active. That's a query. Note that I'm not necessarily returning all the full objects. I don't want to necessarily return entities from queries because that can lead to things like mass assignment vulnerabilities. For those who are aware of what that is, it's basically when you send everything to the client and then when you save, you take everything the client sends you and you just save it into the database. Rails applications were vulnerable to this for quite a while. GitHub had a very well-published problem about this where people were sending user account details to the client. They could change their admin flag, update their account, send it back, and now I'm an admin on GitHub. Happy days. Obviously, that's been fixed. And that might seem easy to do at the moment, but let's say I've got this here with user account, and I start adding more properties to the user account that I don't want clients to see. I can really easily leak information out to consumers that I don't want. So try not to do that. Try to make it as specific as you can. Make sure you return DTOs rather than anything else. And of course, you look at this and you go, hang on, Richard, this is so much more code. Before, I just had like a single class. It was just a couple of properties and that's it. Yeah, it's more code. But if we're thinking about an application and maintainability and some of the other things that come down the path with this approach, then it gives us a lot more flexibility, it's more expressive, it's easier to understand where things exist. I'm looking for a water bottle. Ah, there's one. All right, so command handlers, while I hide down here, as we said, coordinate persistence. So coordinating state change does involve coordinating the saving of state as well. So we want persistence ignorance in our applications. We don't want our entities to know how to save themselves. So the logical place for that is inside a command handler. Make sense? All right. What about query objects? I mentioned query services, query object. A query service is basically the idea there's a class that handles all queries related to a particular entity. Fair enough. A query object is a slightly different approach. It simply says this is an object that represents a single query. Generally, it's a property bag, and all the query objects have the same pattern and something like execute or run or some other method that they all do, which is the actual querying. So we could do the active accounts query. Instead of running it as a method in the service, we simply run it here as a single class. And you can see, in this case, I don't need any parameters, but I have an execute, it returns data. I don't really care which way you want to do this. It's up to you and how you manage your code, whichever way makes most sense for you. Like all things in architecture, there's a trade-off. If I've got a query service, I end up having potentially lots of methods in a single class if I've got, you know, a large entity I'm querying on. If I use query objects, I might have a proliferation of small classes that I then have to figure out how to manage in terms of organizing my application so they don't end up just spreading everywhere. Make it easy to find. So you're just trading those two concerns off more than anything else. Now, common question I get from this is that if you think about the account class that we looked at with the activate and deactivate methods, and I've got a command handler, well, do I really need this whole activate and deactivate method? I can just get the command handler to call the flag on the activate is active property, correct? I might as well just, you know, command handler comes in, just goes account.isActive equals true, save. It's a really easy bit of code, very simple to do, nothing really going on. Sure, I can do that. Looks like that. And if you think about properties in .NET, they're automatically separating our updates from our reads, getters versus setters. It's implicit. That there, though, what is that? Anyone know that? C#. And a smart-ass award goes to. That's what we call an anemic domain model. Anyone heard the term? Okay. The anemic domain model is basically saying our domain model doesn't have any behaviors in it. It's just a property bag. All properties, no big deal. All the domain logic lives somewhere else. Is an anemic domain model okay? I'm going to give you the consultant answer, which is... yeah, it depends. Always it depends. The real thing to consider with whether you do an anemic domain model or not is what happens over time. One of the things we want to think about when we architect systems is not what's the requirement today, but what's the requirement in 5 years' time that we haven't yet thought of? What are the needs we've got that we haven't even considered at this point in time? Do I build expecting change, or do I build for today and tomorrow can worry about itself? If that's the case, if you don't care about the future and or your app is just a CRUD app and you're basically rewriting Excel or Access, firstly, I'd say why? Just use Excel or Access. You don't need to. But if behaviors are going to occur and you're going to get new behaviors introduced over time, where do you make those changes? So let's say your user now comes up, well, I don't want you to activate if you haven't validated email addresses. Make changes where they most make sense, which is inside the domain entity. I don't want to embed the behavior in the command handler, because if I put it there and I end up with another command that does something similar but different, I end up repeating my code, and I come right back to that problem we talked about before, where if I need to make a change, I have to make it here, and I've got to remember to make it here, and I've got to remember to make it here. I want to only make changes in one spot. So these things, even though they might not be doing much at this point in time, we're building with an expectation for change in the future so that we can do things like that. Make sense? Okay. Now, how does this help with performance and scale? Great question. Firstly, let's start with queries. Optimizing queries. We've got two aspects for performance. We can optimize our queries and our commands in terms of how they get handled. From a query perspective, if you think about it, queries are just retrieving a projection of data. They're just going to get something from the database, return it to the client. So why do I want to go through Entity Framework, for example, or Anhibernate to get that stuff? I don't need to. I don't need to go through all the business logic to get things. I don't need to hydrate objects to get things back out and try and do complex joins or anything else. I could simply do something a little different, go straight to the database. So yeah, sure, my commands might come in through the handler. They go through the domain. They get business rules applied to them. They change state. But then a query should just be doing that. Skip the domain processing entirely. You've already done all that processing. The data's there. Just go and read it. Too many times I see people writing queries that go through their domain objects again. They go and bring these objects back. They make sure they're all valid. They put things together in application code. You don't need to. Just go to the database. But if we're going straight to the database, we can optimize things further. We can actually denormalize data and have projections that are pre-calculated already. If I know what the query is because it's specific enough, then I can already have the answers ready when a client asks for it. So I can have all of my operations being order one in terms of performance. So I come in, I get my data, and I simply go, UI is going to go get my query, and it's going to handle, the handler picks it up, and I just go get my pre-calculated data. It's a single read, job done. I'm automatically ramping up my performance because I'm no longer doing any complex processing at all on the query side. I can even then use caching, and I can invalidate my cache if the query projections change. I can do all sorts of things to extend on this idea and increase performance. And again, if you think about the web, this is what happens. We get the results. They're already there. They're ready to go. Good stuff. So putting it in a slightly different picture, if I was to play around, you know, this is an architecture talk. I need boxes and lines. This is, by the way, Omar's talk on what's an architect is this. It's just they draw boxes and lines and get paid for it, apparently. Is that right? Yeah. So the UI's got commands. Those are going to get picked up, as you can see, by the service handler. Sorry about the font color there with the main model. Gets persisted through a repository into a database. And then we either can do synchronous or asynchronous updates into some other storage mechanism. It could be in the same database. There's nothing stopping you doing that. And the queries are then going to read that, get our projections, and we don't have to go through OR mapping conversions and all that complexity. All good? All right. Theoretically, scaling becomes easier. Scaling's never easy, but it becomes easier. Because if you think about what we've just done and what I just had on the screen, if I want to scale, unless I've got a read-heavy system, I can scale the read side, the querying, independently from the updates. The command handling. So I can have the command handling coming through one side, and I can have multiple machines handling queries if I've got a heavy query system. Social networks, for example. Stack Overflow, for example. Heavy query systems, lots of reads. Having things with results pre-calculated, already set to go, means that I can have all this running here, and I can scale out this side separately and independently from my command handlers. When you look at how a lot of the big systems work around the world, the highly scaled systems, they do that. And if you think about microservices even further, well, query handlers in themselves are services. If you separate out your different services and don't just have one application doing all your query handling and you have lots of little ones handling queries, you've now got a microservice architecture that you can then scale independently because you've separated out things in a nice and simple way. The approach makes a huge difference. Optimizing commands, on the other hand, it's a little bit harder. Scaling and getting performant writes is a difficult job. I don't really envy anyone who has to do this. But if we think about it, commands describe a user's intent for a domain entity. Domain entities, from a domain-driven design perspective, here's some terminology, exist in a context. So if I'm updating an order, what context does that exist in? Is it a security context for user accounts? Is it a sales context for sales orders? Is it shipping orders for those in logistics? Is it a backfill order? Is it a something else? It depends on the context, right? If we think about things a little further, we go, okay, so commands, they act on the aggregate roots and domain context. What I can do is I can actually separate out my context into different services or different components. So I start breaking these apart. And one part of scaling is simply to say, if my application is dealing with multiple contexts, split them. And I'm sorry if I'm going too fast with the photos, but you can download the slides. I thought you knew that. Everyone knows you can download the slides, right?
Yeah.
You do now. It's okay. I don't mind if you want to take photos. So you can see now I can scale potentially out on the right side as well. If I think about how my commands are working and just have a context for the sales account running as maybe on one machine and another one for shipping on another machine, another one for security somewhere else. And the security one's interesting. Anyone done using OAuth providers or anything like that? Identity server? Identity server is a way of separating this stuff out, right? We're taking a domain context, which is security, and separating it out from the rest of our application context. AD authentication is exactly the same thing. We let AD handle our security context. And we interact with it, but it's a different domain. So this, again, starts building us towards this approach of what CQRS is. If you go beyond that, you need to scale your rights even further. You need to think about how you get streams of data in. You're going to have to think about load balancers, and you're going to have to think about sharding your data and how do I handle things, because most of the time, writes can't be done in parallel on single entities most of the time. You could, if you want, depending on how complex you are, separate out your commands in a single context and have some things handling some commands and others handling another subset, but those commands are probably going to interact with the same entities at some point. And if they're on different servers, you end up having issues with where does the current state of the thing live, and it just gets too messy. You end up having race conditions and all sorts of things that are going to mess with you. That said, it is easier to shard data if you only deal with the aggregate root entities, because you can use things like the key as a natural way of sharding. So if I have a key based on GUIDs, I might just take the first character of every GUID and scale out across 16 different machines and just use a load balancer to inspect the request and then push it to that one, that one, that one, that one, something like that. Different ways of cutting this particular problem apart. Question, do we have to split the data across separate databases? I just showed you a whole lot of sharding there, a lot of scaling and so forth, and I had little different pictures of databases. Do I have to run it in separate databases? Answer?
No.
Of course not. Best approach for any of this is don't split anything until you need to, because as soon as you run distributed anything, you just took your problem and made it worse. You had one problem before and then you went distributed and now you have two. You can keep your normal SQL database. Keep doing everything with that without a problem at all. In fact, SQL has a nice support for CQRS systems. They're called views. You might have heard of them. They're great. Use them. It's okay to have lots of different views. Your DBAs might get a little upset if you have too many of them, but if you buy them beer and pizza, it can be quite amenable. Or if you just put your arm up, like their arm up behind their back and bend them over and say, you give them a knuckle rub on top of the head, something like that. Lots of views is good. You're already pre-calculating the results. DBAs are able to help you make sure those views are really performant, and you're not doing a whole lot of complex SQL queries to try and join data at runtime when a query is made. You've already got those results set to go. So your performance is going to be much higher as a result. Sometimes, though, you might have things like dashboard or aggregation queries where you've got a lot of data to process to get a result, and you might end up running maybe a SQL job, for example, that says, you know, every 30 minutes we're going to calculate the results of this query so that the next time someone looks at the dashboard, we've got our refreshed view of the world. That's cool. That's not a bad idea. From a user experience perspective, just make sure you show when the data was last refreshed so that people looking at the dashboard don't go, is that current or not? Now, hopefully, some of you in the room have picked up the fact that if we're showing last refresh stuff, what I've actually described just here is
eventual
consistency. Because my system as a whole is only consistent once every 30 minutes. We're eventually consistent. This is a really simple approach to it. Now, CQRS does not require eventual consistency, okay? Not required at all. You don't have to do it. But the idea with it is that query data is updated by a separate process than the ones that handle the changes to application state. Okay? This means there's less work for command handlers. We can play around with database tech so that we can have different storage mechanisms based on the types of queries we might be doing. So I might want to query across a graph of data versus across object perspective. So, you know, SQL is good at storing objects. Well, not really. It's good at storing tables and sets of data. But if I wanted to look at graphs of who's related to who and do like recommendation engines, I'd probably want to put that into a GraphDB and I might run that separately. Document DBs would be separate. I can play around with these things now because there's different approaches simply by splitting the commands and the queries. How we typically do this, though, to make it work, is we have our domain entity. When an entity changes because of a command, we raise a domain event. Fairly straightforward. Something changed, the event simply describes what changed, past tense. We put those domain events in some sort of queue in memory or a message bus if we're going distributed, and then we have an event handler that processes that. Those event handlers are generally referred to, are run in denormalizing processes, but it's just something that subscribes to events, listens for them, and then updates a projection. No big deal. The key thing here is those event handlers are really simple. They don't do any logic processing. They don't need to. All the domain rules have already been handled by the command handler. You don't have to do anything complex with this. It's literally, oh, this event happened, change that field. This event happened, change that. Update that record, and I've got my results all pre-calculated still. The command handler, on the other hand, because it's not having to go through things and then think about updating views and other projections and making all this synchronous stuff happen potentially, that becomes simpler, which means it's doing less work, which means you get more performance, which means the scale need for the writes, the command handling, becomes less because you're doing less. Makes it simpler. It also means that I can create new projections and enhance queries that I haven't been asked before without having to go off and change all my command handlers to now go and update a new view or a new projection. That said, as I said, distributed computing is more complex. Dealing with asynchronicity is a bit trickier. You've got to change and rethink about your user experience. So a few things on user experience. Obviously, if your process, the business process, has natural pause points, like Amazon book ordering, you know, it's always referred to as one of those classic examples, build your user experience around that concept. CQRS, because we've got all these commands in, really drive us towards this task-based UI in terms of a flow. It's very hard to think about commands when everything's a data grid. When you think from a user experience, if everything's a grid and I've just got like this big blob of data and it's just crud, 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 there's only four commands, three commands really. Create, update, delete, that's it. That's not how things work though. How do things normally work? I have an object and I do things to it. And the reason I do those things is user intention. If I think about user intention, I start representing that in the UI design. It changes our UX as a result, and it becomes easier to identify these points where there's handoffs, where there's points where we can pause the process. So that's one idea. Another idea is if someone does something, let's say I've got a user experience or a UI where I've got, say, a list of user accounts on the left, and I have a creation pane. I've got, you know, add new user account. I've got like a field, form I fill out. When I hit save, what has to happen? So the command's going to get sent to the back end, and then I'm going to pass off a user created event to something else that's then going to update our view later on. There's a potential race condition. If I go and refresh my list of accounts by querying straight away, I could make that query before the event has flowed through to the projection. Does that make sense? Can you see that? That would mean, from a user perspective, I've just hit save, things refreshed, but the account I just saved isn't there. I have a sad face, I get confused, the users ring me up, Richard, what's going on? This is not working, your software's crap. Instead, what we do, we just fake it. You hit save on the thing, we simply just go and add your new account that you created onto our list. We don't need to go to the back end to make another query. No point. We know it'll get there eventually. The command succeeded. We know it's worked. So why go and do anything else? Just fake a UI. It's a perfectly valid approach. Or we could put a little spinner there on the screen, because that's always a great user experience thing, and wait for the thing to refresh, and we query and we poll the, we just poll the view until the results are there. Oh, now it's there, now we can refresh ourselves. Or we can play around with things like SignalR and add a whole lot of complexity so that when we send the command, we tag it with an ID and we wait for the view to refresh. And when the projection data is updated by the event handler, it creates a little event itself saying, I've refreshed, and any UI that's listening for my view to be refreshed can now go and refresh itself. Hey, you're adding a whole lot of complexity for not much value. Question?
Regarding the create example.
Yep, that one. No. Stop it. Okay, so commands don't return data. I need an ID for a record I'm going to create, user account or something else. What do I create for an ID? Grids, yeah, absolutely. Just get the UI to allocate a grid and put it through. If you want to do numbers, you can... you can basically do like a block of numbers and let the UI just pull through a block of numbers. So this is how Twitter does tweet numbers, for example, in a highly scaled environment. It doesn't go off and say, give me a number, give me a number, give me a number. It says, give me a chunk, and I'm just going to draw down on that chunk, and when I'm empty, I'll get another block of numbers. There's a little utility called Snowflake that exists that you can do that sort of thing to. I would recommend anyone to avoid doing anything where IDs are meaningful at any variety. So just do grids. If you're worried about databases and I don't want to have, grids as my primary key in a database, you can still in the database use an ID internally, but just have the grid as a second key so you can look it up off that. All right. Question, what happens if a projection or an event handler is buggy? Because this never happens, right? No one has any bugs in their application. So you can do whatever you currently do, which is basically ignore the bug and panic and start writing those data fix scripts and everything else and log it in your issue register and put it right down the very bottom and keep writing new code on top of your bad bugs. Or, I'll leave that aside, or maybe you could do something like this, where you keep a copy of all the events that the event handler has received. You just put them somewhere, maybe a log, something like that. And if there's a problem, because it's just a projection, you could fix your code and just recalculate the projection by just taking all those events and replaying them. So if you take those events, log them, blow the data away and just rebuild it. Rerun it with your corrected code. Because there's no change in application state. These events are things that have happened. We've just not handled it correctly in our code. Well, that approach there is... You guys are ahead of the game. Excellent. Event sourcing, that's all it is. Simply keeping a log of the events. So you can see how we use CQRS. It leads us down these paths to these different patterns of eventual consistency and event sourcing, but you don't need to do this stuff. Event sourcing is not required to do CQRS, as we saw. And you do not need to do eventual consistency to deal with event sourcing. You can do it all in process. Eventual consistency is when we're going across process. You can do all of this in memory without a problem. And the idea here is that every time I change something, I change the state of an entity, I record a stream of the events that have happened. Past tense, events, not commands, the events that have happened. And I, instead of storing the current state and always trying to do something to keep that current state up to date, I simply record the events and I replay those events when I want to figure out what the state of an entity is. So to determine that, we replay the events that have occurred. That's great. This effectively gives us an audit log of the entire system, the what happened. And if we stick some metadata around it, the why, we can actually tag it with the command that triggered the event as well. But it's a reference. You can get historical data. You can go back, what was the system like 3 weeks ago? Anyone get asked for temporal queries? As part of their requirements, you've got to figure out what something was at a certain point in time and figure out what's changed. It's a pain in the butt. SQL, we have to do change data capture and try and do things like that, correct? Yeah, which is so easy to work with. Or you do audit logs and you put everything in Nlog or Log4Net or something like that, and you try and work your way back through your logs going, I hope I captured every event I need to. Maybe I forgot one. This avoids that problem. You can also then use those events to deal with queries you haven't thought of before, as we talked about. We can also analyze those streams of events for behavior. So this is where things like fraud detection comes in, or where stolen credit cards get picked up. If you can identify different patterns in the events that occur for a particular thing, like a credit card when it's stolen, generally people try and do a transaction for like $1 or $2 or something like that. And then they try another transaction shortly after for a larger amount. And then they go, ha ha. If you can pick up those two small events first, you can then lock the credit card before the big one happens. This is, you know, where these things come into play. Storage for events is a piece of cake. It's just a stream, so it's simply just either an append-only table inside SQL, or you can put it in a flat file or something else. So geteventstore.com is an event store database. It's basically a flat file. You just keep sticking stuff on the end of. It's just serialized. That said, again, architecture, right? There's always trade-offs. It's a simple concept, but the implementation, not so much. Your code does become more complex with this. To give you an example, what happens with performance? So, of course, you're going, hang on, all these events, do you know how many events I have in my system? Do you know how much extra processing that would represent? Most entities or most aggregate routes generally, rule of thumb, experience, would say there's 50 or so on average events for most aggregates in their lifetime. Once you go through the initial creation, you get stuff happening, but it's not a huge volume of change. Replaying 50 events doesn't cost much. If they're stored as a stream, they're not huge amounts of data, so I can probably read it in a single I.O. from disk. It's just read a page off the disk, process it, job done. So it's a little bit of I.O. and a little bit of CPU. It's not hugely expensive. If, however, you do end up with a massive chain of events, big thing, millions of these things, you don't want to read them all at once. What you can do is a technique called snapshotting, where every X number of events, you take a new snapshot of whatever the current state is, and then when you want to rebuild state, you read the last snapshot. That's going to be against a certain event number, and then just replay unprocessed events from the last snapshot. So two IOs and a little bit of CPU again. It's not too dramatic. But of course, snapshotting, streaming of events, it's a little bit more complex. Don't do this if you don't need to. I would not recommend anyone do event sourcing straight away. It's kind of like running a marathon before you've gotten off the couch for the first time. If you're as fit as I am, you'll basically get the first kilometer and then you'll fall flat on your face. Water, water. We don't want that. I'm just going to jump through this very quickly. One of the things that people make a mistake on is they, when you do this approach, you actually have to change the way you build your entities. So this is our product class. Could have been the user account one. What you note here is this is a little bit weird. Let's say I'm creating a new product, right? I'm going to have a domain event saying product created. That's going to get triggered, whatever else. So I have the constructor, I validate the name, you know, do whatever the business rule check is, and then I'm simply not changing state. At the end of this method, or at this point in time, I haven't changed any properties. The product itself is not really initialized. What I do is instead I create a product created event with the appropriate properties on it, and then apply that event straight away. Applying the event, that process behind the scenes adds an extra event to the stream. So it creates a stream for this object and then puts the first event in that stream and then immediately does the state change. This is a weird approach. First time I saw this and played around with it, it's like, hang on, this doesn't make sense. But then I understood why. Because if I wanted to rebuild the state of this object normally and I get the product created event, and I need to build an object back up from memory because let's say I turn the whole system off, right? What has to happen? Well, I have to come back and I'd probably have to call the constructor again to change state, right? But if in here I was sending email notifications, Or let's say it was the user account and I was sending, please validate your account. And every time I restarted the system, I sent a please validate your account to every user in my application. I'm not going to be very popular. Because there's side effects to commands, but there's no side effects to replaying an event. Clear? Do I need to give you a bit just to think, ask the questions? I've lost you. It's okay. All right, so in terms of where we're at, we've looked at CQRS, we've looked at some sample code, we've thought about some of the complexity and so forth that occurs, and there's different levels. We're not quite done, but you can ask a question.
Okay, yeah, because it was on the previous slide.
This one here? This one. Yes. So what happens? The question is, what happens if the events change? You know, what happens over time? So you have to deal with versioning. And this, again, adds to complexity, right? So I might have a product created event at this point, and then over time I add new fields. Probably I can do one of two things. One is I can handle nulls in here and change the code so that if I add a new field and I look at my old product created events that don't have that property there, I have some sort of sensible default that I supply. If it's a breaking change and maybe we, you know, the product created, we got rid of description or something like that, and I can't replay those events anymore. Now I might have to have a product created V2 kind of event. I have to leave my old ones there because I still have to be able to replay them because these are things that have happened. But I then handle my new events from that point forward. So I end up with an apply for a product created V2, for example. This is another place where snapshotting can help. What I could do if I wanted is I simply go, from this point forward, I'm going to ignore all the old events in the system. I'm just going to snapshot this thing and then move forward from this point. There's pros and cons to both approaches. Probably the hardest part with this is if I introduce a new query and I want to look back at the history prior to the snapshot, what do I do? So this is why I don't recommend you go down this path, especially early on. Learn to go through normal CQRS first. Just get that scaling and performance sorted out. Create queries that are optimized for reading. Think about scaling your commands. Think about even writing commands in the first place because there's a design part there. Then potentially the eventual consistency aspects and then this maybe. Just because you read it in a blog doesn't mean you should do it. That's number one takeaway, right?
What have you said of Ignite?
Oh, definitely do it, definitely. All right, now the DevOps part. Let's say we build our application. We can theoretically support scale and all that sort of stuff. The ops guys are going to want to know what's going on. So how do I know what's happening in production? How do I diagnose performance problems? If there's an exception, can I figure out what the cause is? How do I trace actions across multiple command and event handlers? How do I see the flow of things in my system? And if you've looked at things like the Netflix blog where they talk about their microservices as well, this gets really messy because they can have one UI command come in that triggers off calls to about up to, I think they say, around 100 different microservices. Trying to trace that sort of stuff is really difficult. The basic approach is this. You start off with tagging every command and query with some sort of operation ID. Straightforward. Then you add on to that any context that's relevant. So, you know, you might have the user ID or the browser information, date and time, whatever else you need to do. And then make sure that any domain events you raise from the command in particular are tagged with information about the command that it came from. Make sure. That way you're making certain that you've got some sort of way of following things through the system. And then obviously any domain events you can add information you want on your own. The good news is, while this might seem complex and you think there's a huge amount of code for it, there's this little thing called Application Insights you might have heard of. Anyone played with this? Ooh, surprising numbers. Anyone using it in real fire environments? And nice. So for you guys, this is great. Do you want to come up here and do this demo? Basically, there's you've got a telemetry thing you can use. You can add telemetry to all your calls. So you add Application Insights, it starts putting all the tags on things, and you can add telemetry to make tracking of this stuff much easier. So let's actually have a look at how this works. And I'm just going to switch across and put my eyeballs on. Okay, so this here is just some sample code. This is from a project called CQRS Lite, which is a simple framework you can look at online that makes doing what I just showed you a lot simpler. It's a framework that supports the approaches. It deals with some of the tricky things like applying events and getting streams and all that sort of stuff. Feel free to have a look at that. Feel free to look at some of the alternatives that are out there. There's plenty of them. And what we've got here, even though it's a little hard to see, is a sample application in here that has a read model or a projection. So again, different terminology. So we have views of inventory items, and there's a little in-memory database, and I've got commands here. So the command itself, you can see it's just a representation of what's in the command. It's just the property bag, nothing too complex. And then there's a command handler here, which is doing things. And you can see what I've done on the code is I've added application insights telemetry object, and I'm simply adding this track event call into the code at the start and end. So I'm saying I've received a command and I've finished the command processing. That will end up in the Application Insights portal, and it's visible in Visual Studio. So you can see here I've got this little thing here, which is telling me, I'll just zoom that up so it's a bit easier to see, that I've got Application Insights in my my VS. This is VS 2015 that I'm using. I'm not using 2017 for demos. I want to show you stuff that's RTM'd at this point. And we can see what's going on. So I'm going to run this app. It's the best UI you've ever seen. The best. Wait for it. You're going to be impressed. Look at that. Oops, wrong button. Don't do that. Isn't that great? Love it. Love it. So I'm going to add an item to my inventory, which is going to be a phone or a Fanoi. Well, Fanoi is not how you spell it, so I better rename that. And you can see the ID on this, by the way. A GUID that we generated from the client. So this answers that question of how to do that before. I'm going to check in that I have 15 of these, which is cool. So now I've got 15 in stock, and I might remove some, move 12. Submit, and I might go and check in some more. I'm going to check in minus 6. Boom, I crashed. Oh, that's a bit sad. So we now have an exception as well. Remember, commands either succeed or fail, and the UI obviously isn't handling the failure at this point in time, but it's just showing you that we've got business rule checks, and it's enough for a sample. Okay? I've also got the portal open here, and unfortunately, if you zoom on the portal, anyone use the portal much? Yeah, have you noticed that if you do browser zoom on the portal, it basically becomes completely unusable? So I'm using Zoomit just to make some of this stuff easier to see. So you'll see me zoom in and out a little bit. Sorry if it makes you seasick. All right, I have App Insights here. So firstly, actually, let's do the live stream. So if you haven't played with this, App Insights has a nice live stream. It's going to connect into any applications that are sending me telemetry, which includes the browser here. And if I simply go back here, we'll go back to the start of the app. And I do something like, actually, let's go back and add a new one. Something, great name, Richard. Good choice. And I check in 15 items. Whatever, we can see in the metrics, if I just pause that, we can see that I've got requests, I've got durations, and I can see I've got a slow request here. Can you see that? I've just put the mouse over it. That was good. So there's a slow request here. Most of them are pretty quick, but I've got a slow one. That's interesting. We might have to have a look at that. And because there's so many things, a little line just helps me see where it is on all the charts so that I can check what's going on. Was it to do with memory? No, memory was okay. CPU looks fine. Nothing really went wrong there. So, okay, that looks all okay. So what I'll do is I'll just jump back over here. And in my results, I'm going to look at performance for a second and get a view of what the performance of the application's been over the last Let's just make sure my time range makes sense. 30 minutes. Update. All right. There we go. So here's some requests that have been coming through. And if I look at the list, I can see the ad one there. The average time is 1600 milliseconds. That's interesting. Probably a little slow. So I can then click on that and I will get another view showing what's happening with that particular operation. And within that, if I drill down a bit further, I end up with, let's go, there it is, a little note down here saying all the available telemetry for this operation. So this is now going to be all those events that I've created internally. So while App Insights will by default give me things like the REST operations or any web calls, I want to know what's going on under the hood. If I've got simple commands and queries and so forth, it's really easy to add that telemetry before and after each of the calls, so I can just go, give me the telemetry details, and it will say, here's what happened, here's the URL that got called. That was the details on it. We then received a create inventory item command in our telemetry, which is the one I showed you before. That caused an event to be created called the inventory item created event, which got processed, and then the command processing was completed. And if I look at the time, I can see there's actually a bit of a gap here. If I wanted, I could probably get a little bit more fancy with this whole thing and go into the analytics view. So with App Insights, there's an analytics feature, which I'm going to avoid at the moment, just in the interest of time. But if I click on one of these, I might go to the create inventory item and have a look at the details on it. And I'll just zoom it up. And you can see it's got event time and name. And then I've got some custom data. So I added some extra metadata of my own, which is the item ID, 84, whatever the grid is, and then the name of the object, which was Fanoi. That's how you pronounce that, right? Fanoi. And those are the events I created myself. That's in my code here. If I go and have a look at the command handler, because I know where it is, that's this here. This is how complex it is. I simply create a JSON object, well, just an object, a dictionary, I should say, and then I call track event. I give it the name and I supply any extra data I want. And then at the bottom, I have another event that I've added to supply any data I want. And you can see, hopefully, why my code is so slow. I left a debug thing in there because I was playing around with race conditions before. Oops. This thing never gets to production like this, right? Yeah. So what we're seeing, though, is because I was able to separate my commands and my queries out in terms of the design right from the UI call down, the UI is built around this concept, it was really easy to isolate where a performance problem was. Yeah, it was also really easy because I made sure it was a nice demo. But that concept of where's a fast query, where's a slow query, where's my CPU spikes happening, what's occurring on the server at that point in time, these are all things I can do. And the telemetry that I can add with App Insights means that it's much easier to diagnose where problems are. I could, if I want, play around with other things as well, such as the application map. This is a bit of fun. So the application map will look at the telemetry information and see where it's coming from and tell me what's going on. So it's picked up the fact that I have a client application and a server, and if I was running in microservices with multiple containers or anything else like that, I would be able to see all the interactions that are occurring. Where are the calls going? How are things being bounced around between machines and so forth? So it's a really nice way of visualizing this stuff. And then there's a query tool, which is Project Cousteau, for looking at things as well. So if you wanted to do some of the insights around the stream, so if we were thinking about fraud detection, for example, as an idea, you could start analyzing streams of events and seeing what's occurring and playing around. So jumping back to the other one, I know that was a quick demo. Just as a recap, in terms of where things are at, so we've looked at CQRS in its various forms, from the simple basic structure, why we do it, how does it support scalability, how can we start thinking about performance and optimizing queries in particular if we've got mostly read-heavy systems, which most applications are. Not all, but most. Anyone doing IoT stuff, by the way? Yeah, IoT is generally going to be write heavy for a lot of things. So you have to think about streaming of things differently. But you also tend to have more events coming in. And those events are event streams that are tied to particular ID. So if you're thinking about event sourcing and IoT, there's a much better match for that, for example, because it's an easier thing to deal with. You're already built around that approach. So performance and scale, we looked at how we might monitor a system that's built with CQRS as a pattern right from the start. And that's pretty much it in terms of content. I do want to open up for questions because I'm sure there's a bunch. Obviously, there's evals, and make sure you put them in so you can win your stuff for Spark After Dark tomorrow. Dun, dun, dun. All right, so questions. Yeah, let's start down here.
So, you're saying clients should assign the grid or any kind of primary key.
Yes.
This client on the web browser?
So the question is, clients for creation should assign the grid. And maybe use that as a primary key. So the primary key thing is a storage mechanism. What I need from an architecture perspective is some way to identify an aggregate, whatever that ID is. I don't care if it's a GUID or if it's an integer or it's a string, as long as it's unique, I can identify it. Who should assign that? Where does it come from? It comes from the client. So if it's a browser, yeah, it's going to be from the page.
Yeah, so that's a security breach, right?
Like, why? So the question is, it's a security breach. I'm allowing any client to create an ID.
And that
could be really horrible, right?
Yeah, I can create an ID that blocks somebody else.
You can create an ID that blocks someone else. Okay. With a GUID.
No, because it's my GUID. I'm not...
But it's a different... You can create any old GUID. What's the problem?
Yeah, so I can go
You could. So if you can manage to get a GUID clash, well done. So what's going to happen? So just even if we do, firstly, if we manage to get a GUID clash, what happens? The create command gets fired off. It goes to the back end. The command handler picks up the create request. The create request goes, okay, you want to create this with this GUID. What? This is already here. We throw an exception. What do we do? Well, we give them a 400. Okay, no. Well, we give something back to the client, hopefully something more meaningful than just a yellow screen of death. But the command isn't going to succeed.
Yeah.
Commands succeed or fail. If it fails, what's your UI going to do?
That's okay, but it just has to be handling, right?
Yeah, you've got to. But that's normal. You have to handle these conditions regardless. You have to. What if, here's this one. I create the GUID, I make the call, the command handler is running, and while it's running, someone takes the database down. Okay, or the network drops, or the power fails, I don't know, whatever. There's going to be error conditions. The advantage of having commands and command handlers versus doing everything else is it's all a single thing. It's just do it, and if it works, it works, and if it doesn't, you have to handle it in the UI. So what would I do in my UI? I go, sorry, we can't handle that at this point in time. Please try again later.
That's okay, but giving the mechanism of creating grids to the internet is asking for a DDoS, right?
The question there is, giving the mechanism of creating grids to the internet creates a distributed denial of service attack. Thoughts on that? What do you think? True or false? Why?
No different than a normal record.
Yeah, and there's a thing called a firewall. Hopefully you've got a load balancer in front of your application that can handle and recognize what a DDoS is. Unlike the census site. too soon? sorry if you're an IBM person here. All right, let's ask a different question. Let's go up the back because... up the back. anyone? We'll work forward. All right, yep. So the question there is, with the faking update of a UI, is there times where you do and times you don't? Yeah, absolutely. And there are times where you're going to have different approaches, which is why I kind of represent there's at least three different approaches to this, if not a whole bunch more. With anything, you've always got to think about what makes sense in a usage context and how do I represent information to my users. I could simply say that... I go and re-query the list, and I have at the top information accurate as at whenever the last update time is, you know, which is kind of like those dashboard type processes where you know if you do Power BI and you're playing with data sources with Power BI, you generally have when the data set was last refreshed, and you can show that on the screen so people know when stuff was last looked at. So play around with the ideas and always think about who's using your application and what do they expect to see. So if I hit a create, most people expect that to refresh a list if it's on the same panel of browser. So faking it in that case is okay. If it was a different page and I was navigating to get the list again, I'd probably okay with not faking anything because I can't fake it at that point. I have to go and do a refresh on a different page. Let's go over this side. Over there, yeah. Yep. Okay, so the question for those who didn't hear it, these guys have been playing around with CQRS and are running into the situation where they have some small commands, but then they have these, probably a meta command would be a nice way of describing it, a large command that triggers a whole bunch of smaller commands. How do we implement that? Do we implement it as a single big command that does the universe, or do we implement it as smaller things? So a meta command coordinates change. Exactly the same as a normal command, coordinates change. If the coordination of that change requires calling those other commands, that's okay. It's probably better to do that so that if those smaller commands change whatever the validation is they do within them, for example, because you do some validation in there, as we saw, or the entities they're calling change, whatever else, it'll all just roll up and you'll get a result. You probably find that big meta command probably isn't triggering any state change itself. It might be just calling the other ones. And then just at the end of it, that's it. You end up with potentially talking also about sagas and other stuff. And I process managers and whatever else. I don't want to deal with that here, but because they're related but not tied to the CQRS pattern per se. So I don't know if I quite answered the question, but okay. All right, down the front.
What have you used as event stores in the past, and you typically roll your own or use a...
So the question is, what have I used as an event store in the past? So this is a persistence question. GetEventStore.com, which is an open source product, works pretty well. There's an N event store, which I think can be backed by SQL Server and other databases. You can just roll your own as well. It's not really a problem. Probably the key thing in terms of thinking about these things is where snapshotting and IDs and so forth comes in, and having stuff that supports projection. So Event Store itself has the ability to use JavaScript to create projections, so you can read those projections straight off the Event Store. Add some CPU processing and overhead, but it's a nice way of doing it. So play around with different options. Other question, down here.
If you're separating your queries and commands in terms of microservices, do you end up with double the amount of microservices?
So the question is, if I separate my commands and my queries and I'm doing microservices, do I end up with double the amount of microservices? So I'm going to come back to what's the name of the thing. They're called microservices. So sure, you end up with a proliferation of them. Is that okay? It's architecture. It's up to you. There's always trade-offs, right? It doesn't mean you have to, though. You can have a service that's maybe not a tiny, tiny microservice, a service that's more around domain context, which is what I prefer. I prefer a single service that matches to a domain context and handles the commands there, and a related service that relates to the queries for that service or for that domain context. I like that mix. You could put them both in the same thing, in the same service, but you restrict yourself from a scale perspective, right? Because I can't scale out one side versus the other independently. I have to scale them both together. And as we talked about, scaling writes or scaling command handlers is more difficult. So And probably the other question is, is it doubling our services based on what? What are we comparing to? A monolith? Yeah? That's okay. Do we have more? All right. People are going for food. I understand that. I'm coming with you soon.
If man is not meant to have return value for their yep. void, is the general idea that the interaction between a command and the UI is asynchronous? And if that's the case, how do you handle stuff like validation?
So let me just make sure I've got the question. So commands don't return things.
Yeah.
So is the intent that commands to the command handlers or the UI to the service, is it asynchronous communication? Why? I wouldn't. No, make it synchronous. You've got to wait for a result, an acknowledgement. You can do commands as fire and forget, but then if you do that, how do you figure out if it succeeded or failed? And what happens from a user perspective in terms of the flow? I find that a really... I know there's, again, there's blog posts around doing this, and it should be done asynchronous, and you put your commands into a bus, and it gets picked up from the bus. I'm like, get run over by the bus. That's a silly approach.
Does that mean all the validation is handled like an exception?
Yes. Yeah, so the validation is going to be in a little bit in the command handler, but definitely in the entities themselves. And if the validation fails, throw an exception back to the UI and, you know, handle it appropriately. I'll pause there. I don't want to go too deep. Actually, I will. You don't always have to not return nothing. So, again, thinking about the web, when you do a post to a resource and it creates a new URL, right? So first time you post, you can return, for example, with that a location. It says the new URL you've just created is in location. So if you've looked at REST approaches and all that sort of stuff, it's more like it's not so much a query, it's returning an acknowledgement. And so you can do that if you wish. I tend to avoid doing that, though, because it leads you down to the dark side and you start introducing bad patterns because you go, oh, I can do it here. Maybe I can do it here. And this time I can just do this, and all of a sudden you end up in a bad place. Question again.
So, massively multiplayer online game command is cut the neck. Well, the return can be,
Okay, so hang on. The question is, in an MMO, one of the commands can be a player tries to cut the neck of an opponent.
And the world is changing behind the scenes, right? So it's a massive game and so many different things are happening.
So
the region can be much more than just a score.
But what's happening there in terms of the way MMOs work and lots of online games is they're not making queries. What's actually happening is they're sending event streams to clients. And they're filtering those event streams based on whatever the player's perspective of the world is at this point in time. And something like a attacker player, let's not cut their head, let's just hit them with a sword on and like a Nerf gun. It's, I'm just going to stand over here for a while. That command is handled on the client. It's not necessarily handled on the server. It's handled on the client firstly to see if there's a collision based on its current state of the world. And then it gets sent off to the server and then they do state extra checks and whatever else and bring it back just in case someone's botting the game. But it's always there's an initial check locally first and then there's checks on the server and there's a whole lot of other stuff because you've got latency issues and we won't get there. But if they didn't do a CQRS approach, there's no way they could get to the scale they go to. And they do event streaming and all sorts of things. More questions? All right, we might pause it there because it is food o'clock. I'm going to hang around over in the speaker lounge area. If you've got more questions, come see me. And I'm just going to plug my other talk this afternoon, which is a Docker talk, so 5 o'clock, wherever it is. Thanks, everyone.